You're all right there. You're done. You're not going anywhere. She heard the echo of her father's voice and laughed. Meanwhile, her more mobile creations were yelling in the back garden and would shortly be clattering in with demands to be fed, cleaned, redressed, soothed, listened to, fed again, read books, undressed, and finally crammed into beds, where she could only hope they would stay for a good long time. Thought of Roger, though, lifted her heart. He'd come back from the battle grimy and exhausted, and changed. It wasn't a drastic change, more the solidifying of a change he'd begun a long time ago. He was quiet, but he told her why he felt he had to stay, and what had happened. And she could tell that while he'd been shocked, who wouldn't be, she thought, it was a shock that had left him more visibly determined, and with an odd, quiet sort of light about him that sometimes she imagined she could almost see. "Encaustic," she said aloud, and stood still, squinting at the portraits but not seeing them. Her fingers had twitched the brush she was cleaning into position, wanting to paint. "Not now," she said to them, and put the brush into her box. She could feel the painting she wanted to do of Roger, an encaustic painting, one done with pigments mixed into hot beeswax. It gave you a vivid image, but one with a peculiar sense of softness and depth. She'd never done it herself, but she was seized by the conviction that this would be the right medium in which to catch Roger's light. Any further thoughts were interrupted by the distant sound of the front door, a murmuring of male voices, and then the clumping of Henrika's wooden-heeled shoes on the pineapple floor-cloth, and the louder clump of heavy boots following.
"Ist deine Bruder,"
Henrika announced, throwing open the door,
"und his Indian."
The Indian bowed to her and came up grinning, though she was sufficiently familiar with his face by now to recognize bravado covering anxiety. She smiled back and impulsively took his hand, squeezing slightly in reassurance about the situation, if not the painting. He blinked in shock, then fumblingly raised her hand, evidently thinking she meant him to kiss it. He couldn't quite bring himself to do that, though, and merely breathed on her knuckles in confusion. Brianna glanced up and met her brother's eye. He was keeping a British officer's straight face, but let a trace of humour show in his eyes. "Thank you, Mr. Cinnamon," she said, gently detaching her hand. She spread her skirts and curtsied to him, which made him blush like a very large plum, and made William look hastily away. William could wait, though. She had a sitter who had come to see his finished portrait. "Come see," she said simply, and beckoned Cinnamon. He wouldn't let her call him by his first name, nor would he call her Brianna, evidently thinking that was improper. William must have been giving him etiquette lessons, or maybe that was Lord John. She'd hung a thin muslin cloth over the portrait to keep off gnats and mosquitoes, which had a fatal attraction for linseed oil and drying paint, and now stepped to one side and pulled it deftly away.
"Oh," he said.
His face was completely blank. Her heart had sped up when the young men had come in, and more when the moment of revelation approached. She wasn't as keyed up as John Cinnamon was, but undeniably felt an echo of his nervous excitement. He stood staring at the portrait, mouth slightly open and eyes wide. A little worried, she glanced at William, whose gaze was also fixed on the portrait, but wearing an expression of surprised pleasure. She took a breath and relaxed, smiling.
"You did it," William said, turning to her. "You really did."
He laughed, a soft rumble of delight as he turned back to the painting.
"That is amazing." "It..."
Cinnamon started, then stopped, still staring at the portrait of himself. He shook his head slightly and turned to William.
"Do I really look like that?"
"You do," William assured him, "though not as clean. Don't you ever look at yourself when you're shaving?"
"Wee, but..."
The blankness was fading into fascination, and he drew cautiously nearer to the portrait.
"Mon Dieu,"
he whispered. She'd painted him in his grey suit. He owned only one, with a snowy white shirt and a neckcloth with a lacy fall over the manly chest. William had contributed a small gold stick pin in the shape of a flower whose heart was a faceted pink topaz, surrounded by green foil petals. She'd persuaded him not to wear a wig and to abandon the bear grease pomade with which he sometimes attempted to plaster down his curls, and had painted him with his distinctive red-brown hair left loose to riot over the lovely broad curve of his skull and the faint reflection of it in the skin of jaw and cheekbones. He'd done his best to keep a stoic, reserved expression on his face, but she'd spent enough time talking to him while she sketched that she'd been able to catch the light that danced in his eyes when he was amused. And it danced in his portrait, in a tiny fleck of white touched with lemon.
That!
Cinnamon shook his head and blinked hard. She could see the tears he was keeping back, and felt a wrench of sympathetic feeling for him, though her joy at his response overwhelmed almost everything else. His own feeling overwhelmed him to such an extent that he turned suddenly to her and seized her in a crushing embrace.
Thank you, he whispered into her hair. Oh, thank you.
Henrika, summoned anew, fetched a bottle of wine and three glasses, and they drank the health of John Cinnamon and his portrait.
Can you drink the health of a portrait? Brianna asked, doing it regardless.
Healthiest portrait I've ever seen,
William said, closing one eye and squinting at the painting through his glass of red wine. He turned and raised the glass to Brianna.
We can drink to the artist, though, if you'd rather.
Huzzah!
Cinnamon said, raised his glass to Brianna, and drank it off at a gulp. His eyes were bright, his hair standing on end, and he couldn't stop beaming, stealing looks at his portrait every few seconds, as though to ensure that it hadn't gone away, or suddenly started looking like someone else.
It should dry for a few more days, she said, smiling and lifting her own glass in salute. Do you still mean to send it to London?
To his father, she meant.
I'll pack it for you if you like, so it won't be damaged on the ship.
John Cinnamon stared at her for a moment, looked at the portrait for a long minute, then turned back to her and nodded.
I do,
he said softly.
Papa would arrange for it to go home with a diplomatic friend, I'm sure, William said. Would you like me to ask him?
Cinnamon paused for a moment, considering, but then shook his head. The glow hadn't left his face, but it had retreated a little way.
I'll ask him, he said, and stood up abruptly. I'll go now. I can't sit still, he explained apologetically to Brianna. I'm so happy.
The glow returned, lighting his face like a flare, and he bowed hastily to her and took his leave, clapping William on the back as he went with a friendly blow that nearly knocked him over. She'd expected William to take his own leave, and he did take up his hat, but then he stood for a moment, kneading it absently.
What are the other portraits?
He said abruptly, and nodded at the three portraits, still veiled in muslin.
If you don't mind me seeing them, I mean, he said apologetically.
Of course not. I'd love to have your opinion, since you know what all the subjects really look like.
She lifted the cloth from the largest piece, the portrait of Angelina Brumby, but kept her eyes on her brother's face to see his initial reaction. He looked briefly at first, as though not really caring, but then blinked, focused, walked closer, and broke into a wide grin.
Got her, didn't I? Brianna said, laughing.
That was the expression on the face of every man who met Angelina in the flesh.
You did, William said, still smiling.
She's... How did you make her look like she's shiny? Sparkly, I think, corrected. Yes, that's it. She sparkles.
Thank you, she said,
and would have hugged him if they'd known each other just a little longer than they had.
You don't really want to know the techniques, but it's basically colour. Tiny dabs of white with an even tinier bit of reflected colour from the surface, behind the sparkle.
I'll take your word for it, William said, still smiling.
He turned back to the row of portraits.
You said I know all the subjects. Is one of those the American general, the cavalryman?
She nodded, and without words turned back the veil covering Casimir Pulaski.
William's face was instantly sober, but he moved toward this painting too, and stood before it for a long time, not speaking.
Brianna was still watching his face, and could see on it the memory of the long hours he and Cinnamon had shared with her, standing behind her, protecting her through the dark and the sorrow of that night.
She had struggled with this portrait. Her memories of the dark tent and the endless procession of somber men, many of them wearing the blood and powder stains of the lost battle, had hung about her while she worked, pervasive as the smell of gangrene and unwashed bodies, the occasional gust of wind off the marshes the only relief.
"I couldn't find my way in at first," she said quietly, coming to stand beside him. "There was too much..." She waved a hand vaguely, but he'd been there too. He knew just what too much was. He nodded, and without looking at her, took her hand.
"But you found it finally?"
He didn't say it as a question, but his hand tightened on hers, warm and big.
"What was it, though?"
She laughed, even as her eyes were full of tears. "Lieutenant Hansen." She swallowed, but knew her voice would shake.
She spoke anyway. When he stopped. Afterward, when the rain started and we were all coming away from the tent, he said, I can't say it, it was Polish.
Pozegnani,
William said quietly.
Farewell.
She nodded and took a big breath. That. It was the only thing, just a glimpse of who he was. She blinked, then knuckled away the tears that had oozed out. She cleared her throat and looked at the painting. When I had that, she said, able to breathe again, he wasn't just a dead body or a hero.
I could have done that. Painted him on his horse, charging or whatever. And maybe the army would rather have had one like that. Probably they would, but...
The army has much more feeling than you'd think, he said, with a half-smile. It's not usually a delicate sort of feeling, but it is feeling. And we understand death. This is perfect.
She squeezed his hand and let it go, feeling the tightness in her chest let go as well. She nodded at the final painting, still veiled.
You've already seen that one, though it wasn't finished then. Do you want to see it?
Jane, he said.
And she turned to look at him, hearing things in his voice. But his jaw tightened, and he shook his head.
No, he said. Not just now.
He took a deep breath and blew it out with a whoosh.
I dare say you've spent some time at Papa's house whilst you've been in the city.
Yes,
she said, diverted.
Why?
Then you've met Amaranthus.
I have.
I want to talk to you about her.
Chapter 120, in which William spills his guts, mostly. In the end, he told her almost everything. No mention of cold gardens, warm thighs, and black-eyed toads, but everything else. Dotty and the baby, Denzel, General Raphael fucking bastard Bleeker, and Amaranth's account of her husband. His sister said very little, but sat hunched forward on her tall painter's stool, feet tucked back behind the rungs, watching him. She had a face that matched her height, boldly handsome, and with eyes that would brook no insult, but that still seemed warm.
I told Papa, Lord John, everything I'd found out.
His father had listened, pale and intent, sifting the account as William told it, very clearly envisioning the necessity for relaying it to his brother, his knuckles growing whiter as the brutal tale went on.
That can't have been easy, his sister said softly.
He shook his head.
No, but easier than it should have been, for me.
I was a coward. I couldn't... I
couldn't make myself tell Uncle Hal. So I told Papa instead, and left the dirty work to him.
She considered that for a moment, head on one side. She wore no cap, and her hair was unpinned. It fell over her shoulder in a shimmering wave, disregarded. Then she shook her head and thrust the wave back behind her ear, leaving a streak of overlooked white paint from her fingers.
"You're not a coward," she said. "Lord John knows his brother better than anybody else in the world. Probably including his Grace's wife," she added, frowning a little. "There isn't a good way to tell a man something like this, I don't suppose."
"There isn't.
But I've heard your father talk about his brother. He'll know what your uncle feels, and he's tough. Lord John, I mean. Though probably Hal is, too. He can stand up to it if Hal goes nuts, gets really upset," she amended, seeing the look on William's face. "You could tell him, all right, and you'll probably have to, eventually," she added with sympathy. "He'll want to hear the gory details from you, but you wouldn't be able to give him what he maybe needs after hearing it, whether that's a stiff drink."
"I'm sure that will be the second thing he needs," William muttered, "the first being someone to hit."
Brianna's mouth twitched at that, and for a shocked moment he thought she was about to laugh, but she shook her head instead, and the paint-streaked lock of hair fell down along her cheek.
"So," she said, straightening up with a sigh, "Amaranthus is still in love with her husband, and he's still in love with her, and you?"
"Did I say I had any feelings for her?" he demanded irritably.
"No, you didn't."
"You didn't need to, you poor fool," her face said.
"I don't suppose it matters," she said mildly.
"Now that you know she's not a widow, I mean, you wouldn't consider..."
She left that thought where it was, thank God, and he ignored it. She cleared her throat.
"What about Amaranthus, though?" she asked. "What will she do now, do you think?"
William could think of a lot of things she might do, but he'd already learned that his own imagination was not equal to that particular lady's.
"You might just possibly enjoy it."
"I don't know," he said gruffly. "Probably nothing. Uncle Hal won't throw her into the street, I don't suppose. She didn't betray him, the king, the country, the army, and everything else. And she is Trevor's mother, and Trevor is Uncle Hal's heir."
He shrugged. What else could she do, after all?
He heard the echo of his uncle's voice above the sounds of Mareham grass and water.
"If you consider treason and the betrayal of your king, your country, and your family a suitable means of solving your personal difficulties, William, then perhaps John hasn't taught you as well as I supposed."
"Divorce," his sister suggested. "That seems cleaner. And she could marry again."
"Mm-hmm."
William was envisioning just what might have happened if he had acceded to Amaranthus's suggestion, and then discovered Benjamin's continued existence, possibly after having father.
"No," he said abruptly,
and was startled when she laughed.
"You think this situation is funny?" he said, suddenly furious.
She shook her head and waved a hand in apology. "No, no. I'm sorry. It wasn't the situation. It was the noise you made." He stared at her, affronted.
"What do you mean, noise?"
"Mm-hmm."
"What?"
"That noise you made in your throat."
"Mm-hmm."
"You probably don't want to hear this," she added with grossly belated tact. "But Da makes that sort of noise all the time, and you sounded just like him." He breathed through his teeth, fighting back a number of remarks, none of them gentlemanly. Evidently his face spoke for him, though, for her face changed, losing its look of amusement, and she slid off her stool, came to him, and embraced him. He wanted to push her away, but didn't. She was tall enough that her chin rested on his shoulder, and he felt the cool touch of her paint-streaked hair against his heated cheek. She was muscular, solid as a tree trunk, and his arms went round her of their own volition. There were people in the house. He could hear voices at a distance, footsteps, thumps, and clanking. Tea being served, he thought vaguely. It didn't matter.
I am sorry, she said softly, for everything.
I know, he said just as softly. Thank you.
He let go of her and they parted gently.
Divorce isn't a simple matter, he said, clearing his throat. Especially when one of the parties is a viscount and the heir to a dukedom. The House of Lords would have to vote and give consent on the matter, after hearing a full account of everything, and I do mean everything, all of which would be meat for the newspapers and broadsheets, to say nothing of gossip in coffee houses, taverns, and all the salons in London. Though I suppose, he went on, reaching for his hat, that a divorce might well be granted. Having your husband convicted of treason seems like sufficient grounds. The results might not be worth it, though.
He punched the crown of his hat back into shape and put it on.
Thank you, he said again and bowed.
You're welcome, she said, any time.
She smiled at him, but it was a tremulous smile, and he felt regret at having worried her with his troubles.
As he turned to go, he caught sight once again of the row of portraits, one still shrouded. She saw him glance at it and made a small interrupted gesture.
What is it? He asked.
It's nothing. I don't want to keep you.
I have very few demands upon my time at the moment, he said, smiling. What is it?
She looked dubious, but then smiled too.
The painting of Fanny's sister. I wondered whether you knew if the original drawing was made during the day or at night. I painted it as though it was daylight, but it occurred to me that, given her occupation and the fact that a client of the establishment drew her, it might well have been in the evening, he finished. You're right. It almost certainly was.
He nodded at Jane, invisible behind her veil of muslin.
It would have been at night. There was a fire in the parlour, well, the one time I was in it, at least, and the walls were red, so there was a bit of that in the air. But I only saw her by candlelight. A candle with a brass reflector, a little behind and above her, so the light glowed on the top of her head and ran down the side of her face.
Her brows, thick for a woman, rose. You recall her very well, she said, with no tone of judgment. Have you ever drawn or painted yourself?
No, he said, startled. I mean, I had a drawing master when I was a child.
Why? She smiled a little, as though harbouring a secret.
Our grandmother was a painter. I was thinking you might have inherited something from her, like I did.
The thought made his hands curl with a slight shock that went through the muscles of his forearms.
Our grandmother. Jesus, he said.
She looked a lot like me, Brianna said casually, and reached to open the door for him. And you?
That's where we got the nose.
Chapter 121. The Quality of Mercy. Fraser's Ridge. I was in the surgery, sorting seeds and enjoying the satisfaction of successful hoarding, when I heard a tentative knock at the front door. The door itself was open, to let fresh air flow through the house, and normally whoever was at the door would have called out. I heard faint whisperings and the shuffle of feet outside, but no one called, and I poked my head out to see who the visitors might be. To my surprise, there was quite a crowd on the porch, a number of women and children who all stirred with alarm at seeing me. One woman seemed to be the leader. She plucked up her courage and stepped forward, and I saw that it was Mrs. McElhenney, Mother Harriet, as she was called by everyone, white-haired, widowed 3 times, and mother to 13 children and untold quantities of grandchildren.
By your leave, Ivana Weister, she said, her voice hesitant, might we speak with himself?
I said, disconcerted, yes, of course. I'll just tell him you're here. Won't you come in?
I sounded nearly as hesitant as she did, and for the same reason.
There were five women besides Mother Harriet: Doris Hallam, Molly Adair, Fiona Leslie, Annie MacFarland, and Gracie MacNeil. All of them were wives or mothers of tenants Jamie had excommunicated, and it was reasonably clear why they'd come. They'd brought nearly 20 children with them, from 10-year-old girls with their hair neatly braided to skirt-clinging toddlers and babes in arms, all scrubbed within an inch of their lives. The smell of lye soap rose off them in an almost visible cloud. Jamie was sitting at his desk with a quill in his hand when I came in, closing the door of the study behind me. He glanced toward the door. The whispering and shushing was clearly audible.
"Is that who I think it is?"
"Yes," I said. "Five of them, with their children. They want to speak with you."
He said something under his breath in Gaelic, rubbed his hands hard over his face, and sat up straight in his chair, squaring his shoulders. "Aye, let them come in, then."
Harriet McElhenney came in with her head up, jaw clenched, and chin trembling. She stopped abruptly before Jamie's table and collapsed onto her knees with a thud, followed by the other wives and half the children, spilling out into the hallway, all looking bewildered but obedient.
"We've come to beg thy mercy, Laird," she said, bowing so low that she spoke to the floor. "Not for ourselves, but for our bairns."
"Did your husbands put you up to this?" Jamie demanded. "Get yourselves up, for God's sake."
"No, Laird," Harriet said.
She rose slowly, but her hands were pressed so hard together that the knuckles and nails showed white.
"Our husbands forbade us to come to you. Said they would beat us should we stir a foot out of doors.
The Gomerals would sacrifice us and the bairns for the sake of their pride, but we came anyway."
Jamie made a Scottish noise of disgust.
"Your husbands are fools and cowards, and they'll pay the price of their foolishness. They kent what they were risking when they chose to cast their lots wi' Cunningham."
"Does a gambler ever think he'll lose, Laird?"
Jamie had opened his mouth to say something further, but shut it at this shrewd stab. Harriet McElhenney had lived on the ridge almost from its founding, and knew very well who was the biggest gambler in this neck of the woods.
"Mm-hmm," he said, eyeing her. "Aye, well, be that as it may. I've said what I've said, and I will not go back. I put these men out for good cause, and that cause hasna vanished, nor is it likely to."
"No," Harriet agreed, real regret in her voice. She bowed her capped head.
"But my six grown sons are loyal to ye, Laird, and to the cause of liberty, and my four brothers as well. Many of these good women can see the same."
She gestured to the serried ranks still kneeling on the floor behind her. "And do." A murmur of agreement came from the crowd behind her, and one wee girl poked her head out from behind Harriet's apron and said brightly, "My brother helped bring you back from the landslide, sir." Harriet moved her skirts to obscure the child and coughed, the interruption giving Jamie enough time to look over the women and calculate exactly how many sons, brothers, uncles, grandsons, and brothers-in-law they possessed among them, and how many of those were the men he either included in his gang or would like to. I saw the colour rising up his neck, but I also saw the slight slump of his shoulders. So did Harriet, but was wise enough to pretend not to notice. She folded her hands in front of her and humbly laid the rest of her cards on the table.
"We ken weel why ye banished the men, sir, and we ken even better the kindness that you've always shown to us and our families. So, we'll swear ye an oath, Laird, a most terrible oath, in the names of St. Bride and St. Michael, that our husbands shall never again raise hand or voice against you in any matter."
"Mm-hmm."
Jamie knew he was beaten, but he wasn't surrendering just yet.
"And how do you mean to guarantee their good behaviour, Ivana Weister?"
An inaudible but clear vibration that might have been amusement ran through the older ladies, though it vanished in an instant when Harriet turned her head to look over her shoulder at them. When she turned back, her eyes were fixed on me, not Jamie, which gave me a start.
"I suppose your wife could answer that for you, Laird," she said circumspectly,
and let the corner of her mouth tuck in for a moment. Her gaze dropped to Jamie again.
"None of the men can cook. But if you dinna trust what a wife might do to a husband, who's taken the house from over her head and the food out of her bairns' mouths, perhaps you can imagine what the brothers and sons of those wives might do to him. If you'd like me to have my lads come and swear that same oath to you."
"No," he said very dryly. "I'm no a man to discount an honest woman's word."
He looked over the crowd slowly and sighed, putting his hands flat on the desk.
"Aye. Well, then, this is what I'll do. I will revoke the letter of banishment for your husbands. But the contracts I made with them as tenants remain void, and you'll send your husbands to me to swear their fealty. I will not have men on my land that may plot against me. But I shall write new contracts between myself and each of you ladies for the tenancy of the land and buildings you live in witness of the faithfulness of your faithful husbandry of the same."
A definite titter ran through the room, and I smiled despite the seriousness of the situation. Jamie didn't laugh, but leaned forward, fixing each woman in turn with his eyes.
"Mind, this means that each of you, each one, I see, is responsible for the rents and other terms of her contract. If you want to accept your husband's advice and help, that's well and good. But the land is yours, not his. And if he should prove false, either to you or to me, he'll answer for it to me, even unto death."
Harriet nodded gravely.
"We agree, my laird. We're most grateful for your kind forbearance, and even more grateful to God that he's let us save you from the guilt of putting women and children out to starve."
She dropped him a deep curtsy, then turned and went out, leaving her followers to curtsy to him each in turn, and murmur their thanks to their speechless, red-eared landlord. They left, murmuring to one another in excitement, and leaving the door open as they'd found it. A cool breeze came down the hallway carrying the ghost of lye soup. I put my hands on Jamie's shoulders, hard as rocks, and so were the columns of his neck under my thumbs.
"You did the right thing," I said quietly, and began to massage the tight muscles, searching out knots.
He sighed deeply, and his shoulders dropped a little.
"I hope so," he said. "I'm likely nourishing a wee brood of vipers in my bosom. But it does lighten the weight on my heart."
After a moment, he added, still looking down at his desk,
"I did think of the other men, Sassenach. The brothers and sons, I mean. But what I thought was that they'd take care for the women and children, feed them, take them in if their husbands couldn't find a place. I never thought. Christ, it was like having my own guns taken and pointed at me."
"You did the right thing," I said again, and kissed the top of his head. "And you know that now all those women and children will be watching out like hawks in case of any Ranny Gazoo on the western side of the ridge." He turned his head and gave me an eye.
"I dinna ken what a Ranny Gazoo is, Sassenach, but God forbid I should have it without my knowing. Is it catching?"
"Very. Blessed are the merciful, for mercy shall be shown them."
"I'm glad to find you so filled with mercy, Colonel," said a dry voice from the doorway. "I only hope you may not have exhausted your store for the day."
Elspeth Cunningham stood on the other side of the threshold, tall and straight, and dressed in black, a stark white fichu throwing her gaunt features into stern relief. The muscles under my hands went momentarily as hard as concrete. I let go, and then Jamie was on his feet, bowing.
"Your servant, madam," he said. "Come in."
She stepped over the threshold, but stood for a moment, hesitant, a pinch of skirt caught between her fingers.
"Dinna think for a moment of kneeling to me," Jamie said, matching the tone in which she'd spoken a moment before. "Sit down on your hurdies and tell me what it is you want."
I went round the desk and pulled up the visitor's chair for her, and she sank into it, her deep-set eyes still fixed on Jamie.
"I want Agnes," she said without preamble.
Jamie blinked, sat down, blinked again, and leaned back, relaxing a little.
"What do you want her for?" he asked wearily. "Perhaps I should have said, I've come to spear for her," she said with a trace of a smile, "if that's the correct term."
"Only if you want to marry her," Jamie said, "which I suppose is what you mean. Which one of the lieutenants did you have in mind, and what does Agnes have to say about it?"
Elspeth sighed and unfolded her hands to accept the cup of whisky I offered her.
"At the moment, it's 6 of 1 and 6 of the other," she admitted. "The silly creature can't make up her mind between them, and as I've told her, that there's no way of knowing which of them fathered her child, neither has more of a factual claim upon her affections than the other."
"I suppose you could wait till the child's born and see who it looks like," I suggested. I could, within fairly broad limits, discern blood types. That might help, but I thought I wouldn't suggest it right this moment. Just as well, since both of them ignored me.
"That's why I said I want Agnes," she said.
"I've decided that I must accept your offer to provide transport for my son and his household. When he heard of your banishing the men who followed him, he declared that he could no longer remain here without supporters and at your mercy."
"My mercy," Jamie muttered, drumming his fingers briefly on the table.
Evidently I've an endless store of that. So?
"Gilbert and Oliver will, of course, accompany us," she went on, ignoring this. "They naturally do not wish to abandon Agnes."
"Agnes has a home," Jamie broke in impatiently. "Here. Abandon her for by."
"Surely you will admit that they have a responsibility to that girl," Elspeth said, lowering her strong grey brows at him in a way that made her look like a very stern owl.
"I will," he said. "But I'll not see her taken from her home unless she wants to go, and I'm assured of her future welfare. I can find her a good husband here, Ken."
"I am offering you exactly such an assurance," she snapped.
"Do you dare to imply that I would see her abused in any way?"
"You're an old woman," Jamie pointed out rather brusquely. "What if you die on the way to wherever you're taking your son?"
Where are you taking him?" I interjected,
more in hopes of stopping the conversation going straight off the rails than because I wanted to know.
"Would you die if you knew someone was completely dependent upon you?"
she shot back, ignoring me.
He paused for a moment and took a breath before replying evenly.
"You have not always got a choice about it, Elspeth."
Elspeth's nostrils flared as she inhaled, but she replied calmly.
"Yes," she said, "you do.
Barring being shot through the heart or struck by lightning," she added, as one obliged to honesty. "But one of the few advantages to being an old woman is that no one shoots them. As for the lightning, I shall leave that to God, but my trust in him is considerable." "As to our destination," she said, turning to me as though Jamie had ceased to exist, "Charlestown. There are navy warships there, and a large number of smaller frigates and army transports. Charles has written to Sir Henry Clinton asking the favour of transport back to England aboard one of these. Sir Henry has known our family for many years and will certainly grant us the courtesy. Now, as to Agnes." She switched her focus back to Jamie. "I will admit that my desire to take her with us is not solely for her benefit. Cleanly, I need her." There was a long moment of silence with that simple declaration hanging in the air. She did. The two young lieutenants would manage the physical difficulties of travel and provide protection for her and Charles. But she would need help, in caring both for her son's demanding physical needs and for her own. Granted, she could easily engage a maidservant, but given Agnes's delicate situation. No one had mentioned the other aspect of that situation aloud, but Elspeth was more than perceptive enough to have grasped the fact that, everything else quite aside, she was an answer to prayer for Jamie. I estimated the pregnancy at roughly 3 months, and it was a matter of weeks, if not days, before Agnes's situation was known all over the Ridge. And it was, naturally, Jamie's responsibility as her employer to resolve the situation in some publicly satisfactory manner. Finding the young man responsible and obliging him to marry Agnes would be the usual thing, but under the circumstances, to have your unmarried maidservant growing visibly pregnant in your house, or hastily married off to someone who was patently not the father, was to invite speculation that you had had something to do with her condition. And we'd both been there before. I shivered, the echo of Mulver's denunciation, "It was him," ringing in my ears. "Speaking as Agnes's, other loco parentis," I said. Jamie and Elspeth both smiled involuntarily, but I ignored them and pushed on. "I have a small condition to suggest. I'll help you to persuade Agnes, because I think it's really the best way of handling her predicament. But if she decides to go with you, I want an assurance that you'll provide her with an education." "Agnes?" Both of them had spoken together, and while Jamie's intonation indicated doubt and Elspeth's amusement, their unanimity did give me a moment's pause.
"Education to do what, Sassenach?" Jamie asked. "Fanny's taught her to read, and she can write her name and count to 100. What else do you think she'd find useful?"
"Well," it was true that while Agnes was pretty, amiable, kind, and willing, and had a certain shrewd perception born of experience, she wasn't a natural student. Still, there was no telling what might happen to her, and I wanted her to be safe. "She should know enough arithmetic to be able to handle money," I said finally. "And she should have a little money to handle, of her own."
"Done," Elspeth said quietly. "My son will settle a modest amount on her, independent of her husband, whoever that turns out to be," she added a little bleakly. "And I'll see to her education myself."
No one spoke for a moment, and I began to hear the normal sounds of the house, the clumps and squeaks and rattling and barking, and the sound of distant conversation that the tension of our discussion had blocked out. Footsteps crossed the ceiling over our heads, quick and light, and I caught a murmur and the giggle of young girls amused. I relaxed a little. Fanny would miss Agnes cruelly, but at least she would have the Hardman girls for company. "I'll go and talk to Agnes now," I said. Chapter 122 The Militia Rides Out. Jamie knelt and sliced the stitching of the burlap bag, folded back the top, and breathed deep. Huffed all his air out and breathed deeper, then sniffed thoughtfully. A rich, nourishing smell, nutty and sweet. No scent of mould, at least not at the top. Down at the bottom, though, where the damp settled. He rose and pushed back one set of the big sliding doors that Bree had built for both sides of the malting shed, so they could open it up in fine weather. And it was a fine day, one fit for birdsong, rambling the woods, and maybe fishing a bit near sunset. A morning fit for small peaceful jobs like replacing the board in the malting floor that had caught fire and was blackened enough that it might taint the flavour of the roasting grain. Fit for judging the quality of the barley on hand. He'd harvested 200 weight of grain from his own fields in the autumn, and brought another 100 weight from the trading post, but they'd had time to malt, brew, and distill only half of it, what with an early winter, bad weather, and the disturbance at the lodge in February. He scratched his chest. The scar was well healed, but he could still feel it pull when he stretched his arms wide. He dragged the bag near the open doorway for light and dumped it carefully over the floor, kneeling and spreading it with his hands, looking for sprouting, damp, mould, bugs, or any of the things you might not want in your whiskey. And as a last check, chewed a few grains, then spat them out into the grass.
"Diva,"
he murmured, and got to his feet. He fetched a square malting shovel down from its pegs and shoveled the fresh grain aside, making room for the next bag. A warm breeze brushed his cheek as he opened the sliding door. It was a beautiful day. He'd maybe stop by Ian's and take Lizard to the lake with him tonight. These pleasant thoughts were interrupted by a sudden flapping and crying out of a flock of doves nearby, disturbed by something coming. Wary, he took hold of the shovel and keeked out. But it was only a man coming down the path alone. Hiram Crombie. They hadn't spoken since the stramash at Lodge.
"Hiram,"
he said, as the man grew near and lifted his chin in greeting. Crombie's pinched face lightened a little at Jamie's use of his Christian name. He nodded slightly and came closer, still with a wary look in case Jamie had it in mind to bat him over the head with the shovel, Jamie supposed. He stood the shovel in the mound of grain and straightened up, wiping his sleeve across his face.
"I've come to see..."
Crombie started, but then stopped, unsure.
"Aye?"
It came well enough what Crombie had come to say, but he wasn't above making him say it out loud. The old curmudgeon was already stiff as a dried stick, but his arms seemed stuck to his sides. His fists curled slowly.
I regret what happened at the lodge.
Aye?
Silence, broken only by the whittering of birds in the nearby pines, waiting for Jamie to go away so they could flop down and poach the spilled grains. Crombie drew in air through his long, hairy nose. It whistled slightly, but Jamie didn't laugh.
"I wish you to ken that it wasn't the doing of myself, nor my brother, or my cousins.
He stopped and swallowed, muttering,
"Sorry for it," under his breath.
"Well, I ken that much, Hiram,"
Jamie said, stretching his back. The scar across his chest was burning from the shoveling.
"Whatever you think of the king, I didna suppose you'd try to kill me on his account."
Hiram's shoulders began to lower, but before he could get comfortable, Jamie added,
"But I suppose you kent what Cunningham was about, and you didna warn me."
"No."
After a moment, apparently feeling that this wasn't an adequate explanation, Hiram blew out his breath and shook his head.
"No, I didn't. But I kent that Duff and McHugh had a whiff of it. I saw them watching Cunningham when he came out of Kirk like 12 foxes watching a wolf go past.
And they're your men. I thought they'd warn you something was up. But Geordie Wilson, my wife's brother, ken, he's one of Cunningham's. I couldn't speak to you without him getting wind of it, and then..."
"Aye," Jamie said after a moment's pause.
"No man wants trouble in his family, and it can be helped."
Hiram's shoulders slumped in relief. He nodded to himself for a bit and then spoke again.
"A wee time passed. I said I wished to speak with you about a matter."
Jamie remembered. In fact, Crombie had approached him on the way to Lodge that night, which made him feel more kindly toward the man. He couldn't have had a hand in what was afoot if he'd wanted a favour from Jamie at that point.
"He did. About our cravat, I think he said."
"Aye. I wanted to ask you if you'd maybe take him as a member of your militia."
Well, that was a surprise. He'd been expecting a request that Jamie let Cyrus court Francis officially, and he would have said no to that, but this...
"Why?"
he asked bluntly.
"He's 16,
Hiram said, shrugging as though this was a complete answer. And it was. A boy that age needed badly to start being a man, and if he hadn't got a man's proper work to do... The other side of the matter was plain, too. Hiram Crombie was anxious that his family should now be seen to stand solidly with Jamie, and Cyrus was his offered hostage.
"That's reassuring," Jamie thought wryly. "He thinks we might win."
Jamie spat in his palm and offered it.
Done, he said. Send him to me tomorrow, just before dawn. I'll have a horse for him.
Sylvia had volunteered to rise early, very early, and make the gallons of brose and porridge to feed the militia. The warm, creamy smell crept up the stairs and eased me into wakefulness like a soft hand on my cheek. I stretched luxuriously in the warm bed and rolled over, enjoying the picture of Jamie, long-legged as a stork and stark naked, bent over the washstand to peer into the looking-glass as he shaved by candlelight. Dawn was no more yet than a fading of the stars outside the dark window.
"Getting all spruced up for the gang?"
I asked. "Are you doing something formal with them this morning?" He drew the razor over his pulled-down upper lip, then flicked the foam to the side of the basin.
"Aye, horse drills. It'll just be the mounted men today. With the tall tree, we'll have 21.
He grinned at me in the mirror, his teeth as white as the shaving soap.
"Enough for a decent cattle grade."
"Can Cyrus ride?"
I was surprised at that. The Crombies, Wilsons, MacReadys, and Gagans were all fisher folk who had come to us, by God knew what circuitous and difficult means, from Thurso. They were, for the most part, openly afraid of horses, and almost none of them could ride. Jamie drew the blade up his neck, craned his head to evaluate the results, and shrugged.
"We'll find out."
He rinsed the razor, dried it on the worn linen towel, then used the towel to wipe his face.
"If I mean them to take it seriously, Sassenach, they'd best think I do."
The sky was lightening, but it was still dark on the ground, and only a few of the men had gathered when Cyrus Crombie came down out of the trees above Newhouse. The men glanced at him in surprise, but when Jamie greeted him, they all nodded and muttered, "Madden va," or grunted in acknowledgement.
"Here, lad," Jamie said,
thrusting a wooden cup of hot brose into the tall tree's hand.
"Warm your belly and come meet Miranda. She belongs to Francis, but the lass says she's willing to lend you the mare until we can find you a horse of your own."
"Francis? Oh, I thank her." The tall tree glowed a bit and glanced shyly at the house and then at the horse. Miranda was a big mare, stout and broad-backed, and with a gentle, accommodating manner. Young Ian had come down now, in buckskins and jacket, his hair plaited and hanging down his back, Totus following him. He glanced round the group of men, nodding, then kissed Totus's forehead and lifted his chin toward the porch. Then Ian came for his own brose, lifting a brow in the direction of Cyrus.
"A cravat will be joining us, Avalach,"
Jamie said casually.
"Will you show him the way of it to saddle and bridle Miranda while I tell the men what we're about?"
"Aye,"
Ian said, swallowing hot barley broth and exhaling a cloud of white steam.
"And what are we about?" "Cavalry drills."
That made Ian raise both brows and glanced over his shoulder at the group of men who looked like what they were. Farmers. They all owned horses and could ride from the ridge to Salem without falling off, but beyond that...
"Simple cavalry drills," Jamie clarified. "Riding slowly."
Young Ian looked thoughtfully at Cyrus, standing at eager attention.
"Aye,"
he said, and crossed himself. When I went upstairs to tie up my hair before starting the soap-making, I found Sylvia and all four of the girls in my bedroom with Francis, Patience and Prudence more or less hanging over the sill to watch the militia ride out. They barely noticed me, but Sylvia stepped back a little abashed and began to apologize.
"Don't worry at all,"
I said, and stepped up behind Patience to peer out. "There's something about a group of men on horses."
"With rifles and muskets," she said rather dryly.
"Yes. There is." I thought the girls hadn't quite grasped the fact that the militia group was drilling and training for the express purpose of killing people, but their mother assuredly had, and watched the men forming up with the usual calling out and crude jokes, with a certain grimness that deepened the lines bracketing her mouth.
I touched her arm gently, and she turned her head, startled. I know that you and your daughters would prefer to die rather than have other people killed so that you don't. But you know, you're our guests. Jamie's a Highlander, and his laws of hospitality forbid him to let anyone kill his guests. So I'll have to ask you to stretch your principles a bit and let him protect you. Her lips twitched, and her eyes met mine with a gleam of humour. As a matter of good manners.
Exactly, I said, smiling back.
A squeal from the girls drew us back to the window. Jamie was mounted, passing slowly up and down the line of his men, inspecting their tack and their weapons, pausing to ask questions and make jokes. Steam rose from horses and men, their breath white in the cold dawn air. Cyrus was at the end of the line, and young Ian was instructing him on the finer points of mounting a horse, starting with which foot to begin with.
"Oh, doesn't he look fine?"
Prudence said, admiring. I wasn't sure whether she meant Jamie, young Ian, or Cyrus, as they were all more or less in the same place, but I made sounds of approval. It seems to take a long time for the men to organize themselves, but suddenly they all shuffled and jostled into place in a double column. Jamie took his place at the head of it and lifted his rifle above his head. A sort of jingling rumble reached us, and the militia moved out with a visible sense of purpose that was quite stirring to watch. Cyrus, upright as a stalk of uncooked asparagus, rode beside young Ian, the last pair in line. I crossed myself, then turned to my own troops.
Well, ladies, it's a fine day for making soap. Fall in.
Jamie and the Lindsay brothers, with some help from Tom McHugh and his middle son, Angus, had cut down the trees and brush along one side of the wagon road where the land was flat, so that there was no bank between road and forest. They had left 8 big trees standing, spaced about 30 feet apart.
So, Jamie said to his gathered troops, and nodded at the trees. We're going to weave through those trees, going to one side of the first, then the other side of the next, and so on. And we're going to do it slowly, one man following the next after a slow count of 10.
Why? Said Joe MacDonald, squinting at the trees suspiciously.
Well, first, because I say so, Harwich,
Jamie said, smiling.
You always do what your colonel says, because we'll fight better if we're all going in the same direction. And for that to happen, somebody has to decide which direction to go. And that's me, aye?
A ripple of laughter ran through the men.
Oh, aye,
MacDonald said uncertainly. Joe was young, only 18, and had never fought in a battle, bar fists behind somebody's barn to settle a grudge.
But as for why I'm telling you to do this,
he gestured toward the trees.
This is for the horses. We're a mounted militia, though we'll have foot soldiers too, and the horses must be nimble, and you able to guide them through strange ground. Cavalrymen do this sort of drill. It's called a serpentine, because you weave like a snake, eh?
Without pausing for further question, he looked at Ian and jerked his head sideways. Ian nudged his horse and turned slowly out of the group, reined around to face the trees, then leaned forward and with a blood-curdling scream that made all the other horses snort and stamp, dug in his heels and shot for the first tree, as though he and the horse had been fired from a gun. In the instant before collision, they dodged aside and shot toward the next, whipping in and out of the line of trees so fast you could scarcely count the trees as they passed. At the end of the line, they turned on a sixpence and shot back even faster, arriving with a high-pitched Indian yip to shouted applause. Jamie glanced at Cyrus, who looked at once terrified and excited, the reins clutched up to his chest.
So now we'll do it slow, Jamie said. You want to go fast, you?
At the end of an hour, both horses and men were warm, limber, and in high spirits, having, for the most part, avoided collision with each other or trees. The sun was well above the horizon now. They'd best head back so the men could get breakfast and go on to their daily chores. He was about to dismiss them when Ian stood in his stirrups and called over the men's heads.
"Uncle, race you to the bend and back."
There was a general rumble of enthusiasm at this proposal, and Jamie reined round without hesitation, drawing up beside Ian.
"Go!"
shouted Kenny Lindsay, and go they did, thundering down the dirt road in a churn of dust and encouraging Highland shrieks from behind. Ian's horse was a shrewd wee mare named Lucille, who didn't like being beaten, but neither did Phineas, and it was hell for leather all the way and the forest a green blur beside them. They hit the big bend in the road and shot round it to make the turn. Lucille swerved suddenly, shouldering Phineas with a thump that nearly unseated Jamie, and he caught a glimpse of a wagon in the middle of the road, but no time to look, occupied as he was in staying in the saddle and getting Finn back under control. There were shouts behind them, thundering hooves, and two or three gunshots. The whole militia had let exuberance boil over and joined the race, God damn them. Finn was curveting and jerking, and while it took no more than seconds to bring him in mind of his duty, the whole boiling of men and horses was down upon them, shouting and laughing. He stood in his stirrups to call out, furious, and then saw the wagon that had startled Lucille, its mules twitching and stamping in their traces, but not so spooked that they meant to run. The rampage had come to a swirling, mud-churning halt round the wagon, and there was a moment's silence in the shouting. Bree was holding the mules and doing a fine job of it, he saw. Beside her, Roger raised both hands high.
"Don't shoot," he said gravely. "We surrender."
Jamie poured the last of the JF special whiskey into Roger's cup, picked up his own, and raised it to the company round the dinner table, and scattered over the kitchen to boot. This including young Ian's family as well as his own, Sylvia and her lasses, plus Cyrus Crombie, Murdo Lindsay, and Bobby Higgins, the unwed and widowed men who'd come back with him after the militia's drilling.
"Thanks to God for the safe return of our travellers," he said, "and," bowing to Roger Mack, "for the guidance and blessing of our new minister of word and sacrament, Slangeva."
Roger Mack didn't blush easily, but the warmth he felt showed in his face as well as in his eyes. He opened his mouth, probably to say modestly that he wouldn't be truly ordained till the summer, when the elder ministers could come from the coast, but Bree put a hand on his knee and squeezed to stop him, so the lad just smiled and lifted his cup in response.
"To family," he said, "and good friends."
Jamie sat down, amid the resultant shouts and poundings on the table that made the dishes dance, smiling too, and warm with it forby. The whole room flickered with firelight, and the changing faces lively with talk and food and drink. He wished that Fergus and Massali and their bairns were here too, but Roger had said they left Charlestown with the Mackenzies, but then turned north, meaning to have a look at Richmond as a possible place to resume their printing. He said a brief, silent prayer for their safety. Claire was sat beside him on the bench, wee Mandy sound asleep on her lap, half draped over her arm like a sack of grain and just as heavy. He reached over and lifted the bairn, cradling her against his chest, and Claire bent toward him and rested her head on his shoulder for a moment in gratitude. He saw her hair and Mandy's for a moment, their mad curls swirled together, and felt such love that he kent if he died just then, it would be fine. Claire straightened, and he looked up then to see Roger Mack with something of the same look on his own face. Their eyes met with a perfect understanding, and both of them looked down at the tabletop, smiling amid the scattered crusts and bones. Chapter 123. And the beat goes on. The sojourners, the adult sojourners, slept rather late in the morning,
The children naturally popped out of their beds at dawn and ran down to infest the kitchen. Children being what they are, Jem and Mandy had made instant friends with Agnes and the Hardman girls. Mandy was enchanted with Chastity and insisted upon feeding her breakfast in tiny bites, cheeping at her in a motherly tone, as though Chastity were a baby bird, which made Chastity giggle and snort milk through her nose. Going out to get a fresh pail of milk from the spring house, I met Brianna drifting downstairs, dressed, but obviously not completely awake yet. "How are you, sweetheart?" I looked her over carefully. She was paler and thinner than she had been when they left for Savannah, but a wagon trip of 300 miles through God knew what conditions of weather, warfare, and unpredictable food supplies, managing 2 horses, a husband, and 2 children, whilst sitting on a load of contraband guns disguised as bat guano, would naturally take it out of one. She looked happy, though. "I can't believe the house. It's..." She flung out a hand and looked round, then laughed. "But Dar still hasn't put a door on your surgery." "He'll get round to it." I glanced at the kitchen, but the buzzing and giggling was peaceful, and I took her arm, towing her toward the doorless surgery. "Let me listen to your heart. Hop up on the table and lie down." She looked as though she wanted to roll her eyes, but hopped nonetheless, athletic as a grasshopper, and eased herself down, closing her eyes and sighing with pleasure at the feel of the newly padded surface. "Oh, God, I haven't had a bed this soft since we left Savannah. Certainly not this clean." She stretched luxuriously, and I could hear the soft pop of her vertebrae. "Lord John sends his love, by the way." "Is that what he said?" I said, smiling as I reached for my peanut. "No, he said something much more elegant, but that's what he meant." She opened one eye, regarding me shrewdly. "And His Grace, the Duke of Pardlow, begs me to convey his deepest regards. He wrote sort of a note for you." "Sort of." I'd seen 1 or 2 misses from Hal in the course of my brief marriage to John, and I'd heard a lot more about them from John. "Did he sign it with his whole name?" "Yes, but he was pretty upset. But you know, stiff upper lip and all that." I stared at her. "Upset? Hal? About what?" "Undo your laces." "That," she said, squinting down her long nose at her fingers on the laces, "is kind of a long story." She flicked a glance at me. "I take it, darn you, that William was in Savannah when he suggested I go."
"Lord John mentioned that, yes, in the letter he wrote inviting you to come and paint that society woman's portrait. How did that work out, by the way?"
She laughed. "I'll tell you all about Angelina Brumby and her husband later," she said. She closed one eye, fixing me with the other. "Don't try and change the subject. William."
"You met him?"
I couldn't keep the hope out of my voice, and she opened both eyes. "I did," she said, and looked down while she pulled the last lace from its loop. "It was really good," she said softly. "He came to the Brumbies' house. Lord John just sent him to see the lady painter. He hadn't told him about me either." "What is it with those two?" she demanded, suddenly looking up. "Da and Lord John. Why would they do that? Not tell us about each other being in Savannah, I mean."
"Shyness," I said,
and smiled a little ruefully. "And they both have a sort of delicacy, though you might not think it. They didn't want to put any burden of expectation on either you or William. And Jamie, at least, had been very much afraid that his children might not like each other, and his wish that they would was too important to speak of, even to me." "They meant well," I said comfortably. "How is William?" The underlying delight in her face at being home didn't ebb, but she shook her head with a small frown of sympathy. "Poor William. He's such a good guy, but my God, how does anyone that young manage to have such a complicated life?"
"Your life wasn't that simple in your early 20s, as I recall."
I untied the ribbon of her shift
and placed the flat bell of the pinard against her chest. Poor choice of parents, I expect. Deep breath, darling, and hold it. She obliged, and I listened. Listened again. Moved the pinard. Listened.
Lub-dub. Lub-dub. Lub-dub.
Regular as a metronome and a good strong sound. I put a hand on her solar plexus, feeling the abdominal pulse just in case, but that was just as strong, the firm flesh of her belly bouncing a little under my fingers with each beat. Everything sounds good, I said, looking up, and thinking as I saw her face how very beautiful she was in this instant. Home. Safe. Alive. Are you all right, Mama? She said, looking at me suspiciously because my eyes had gone slightly moist. Certainly, I said, and cleared my throat. Have you had much trouble with the fibrillation? No, she said, sounding a little surprised. It happened 2 or 3 times on the way to Charleston, and once or twice while we were there. Only twice in Savannah, at least bad enough that I noticed. But I don't think it's happened at all, or if it has, only for a few seconds, on the trip back. I kept taking the willow bark, she assured me. Only after a while I started grinding the leaves up and making pills out of them with cheese, because the tea made me pee all the time, and I couldn't stop painting every 15 minutes to go find a chamber pot. I don't think cheese would neutralize the willow bark, do you? No, I said, laughing. Congratulations. You've invented the world's first cheese-flavored aspirin. They didn't upset your stomach? She shook her head and pulled up the neck of her shift. No, but I figured that the cheese might buffer the acid. Don't they tell people with ulcers to drink milk? Yes, that or an antacid. Honey actually works quite well for... I stopped abruptly. She'd just tied the ribbon of her shift, and I'd reach for the laces to hand them to her, but my left hand was still resting on her abdomen a little lower down, and I was still feeling the heartbeat. A faint, fast heartbeat, tiny and busy and very strong.
Lub-dub, lub-dub, lub-dub.
Mama, what's wrong? Bree had sat up, alarmed. All I could do was shake my head at her. Welcome home, I managed to say to the newest resident of the ridge. And then I burst into tears. Amid the uproar of general rejoicing over the news of Brianna's pregnancy and the bustle of reassorting the population of the house, the Hardmans took over the half-finished third floor, tacking canvas over the windows to keep out the rain, and Roger and Brianna moved into their usual room. Fanny and Agnes, being now women, were given their own part of the attic for privacy, but continued to sleep in carefree heaps with the younger children, as did the Hardman girls. It was some time before I remembered the note Brianna had given me. I tucked it in the pocket of the apron I'd been wearing at the time, and found the note several days later when I decided that the apron was really too filthy to be sanitary and had to be washed. The note emerged, a small, neat block of intricately folded paper with a swan flying across a full moon stamped into the wax that sealed it. It was addressed on the outside to Mrs. James Fraser, Fraser's Ridge, North Carolina, but true to John's description of Hal's correspondence habits, had no salutation, and a message consisting of slightly fewer words than was strictly necessary. He had signed it, though. I don't know what you and my brother did to each other, but evidently you're a bit more than friends. If I don't come back from what I'm about to do, please look after him. Postscriptum. Can you recommend to me some herbal preparation of a lethal nature for poisoning rats?
Harold, Duke of Pardlow.
There was a large H under this, presumably in case I didn't recognize him by his title. I set the paper gingerly on top of the pie safe where I could stare at it while kneading bread. I wanted to laugh and did smile,
but it was a nervous smile. For poisoning rats, forsooth. From what I knew of Hal's personality, he might be planning murder, suicide, or the actual extirpation of rodents in his cellar. As for what he was about to do... The mind boggles, I said under my breath, and slapped the elastic dough onto the flowery work table, folding and punching it into a fresh ball. I put this back into the bowl and covered it with a damp cloth, then stood there like a stupefied chicken, blinking at it, and wondering what on earth the Brothers Grey were up to. I shook my head, put the bowl on the small shelf near the chimney, and left the bread to rise while I walked down the hall to Jamie's study. "Have you got a sheet of paper and a decent quill?" I asked.
"Aye, here."
He'd been leaning back in his chair, brow furrowed in thought, but leaned forward to pluck a quill out of the jar on his desk and handed me a sheet of Breeze plain rag paper. I took these with a nod of thanks and, standing by his desk, wrote, "To Harold, Duke of Pardlow, Colonel, 46th Regiment of Foot, Savannah, Georgia. Dear Hal, yes. Foxglove leaves? Mash them and make a strong tea, or just put them in the salad and invite the rats to dinner. Your erstwhile sister-in-law, C. Postscriptum. It's not a good way to die, even for a rat. Shooting is much more efficient." Jamie had been watching me write, reading the message upside down without difficulty, and looked up with raised brows as I finished and waved the note in the air to dry it. I put it down and laid Hal's note beside it in front of him. The eyebrows didn't go down as he read. He looked up at me. "It's meant to be a joke," I said. "The bit about the foxgloves, I mean." He made a restrained Scottish noise and pushed the notes back toward me.
"Maybe you're joking, Sassenach, but he isn't. Whatever he said to you."
Chapter 124. The first time ever I saw your face. Savannah, May the 5th, 1780. From Captain M. A. Stubbs, His Majesty's Army, retired, to Mr. John Cinnamon.
"My dear Mr. Cinnamon, I cannot tell you with what emotion I beheld your portrait. Indeed, my bosom is so animated with feeling that I think my heart must burst between the pressures of guilt and joy. Yet I thank you from the bottom of that squalid heart for your gallant action and the courage which must lie behind it. Let me first beg your forgiveness, though I do not deserve it. I was badly wounded at Quebec, and unable to attend to my own affairs for some months, by which time I had been sent back to England. I should have made inquiries after your mother and made some provision for you both. I did not. I should prefer to think that it was solely shock and disability that kept me from this duty. But the truth is that I chose to forget from selfishness and sloth. I am not a good man. I am sorry for it. And let me next, assuming that your forgiveness be granted, beg that you will come to me. I am astonished by the strength of feeling caused me by the sight of your face, captured in paint and canvas, and even more by the need that has grown in me to see your face truly before me. I can but hope that you would also like to see mine. If you will so far forgive me as to come, I have sent instructions to Lord John Grey, who will arrange your passage to London and provide funds for your travel. I am, sir, your most humble and obedient servant, and your father, Malcolm Armistead Stubbs, Esquire. Postscriptum. Your name is Michelle. Your mother had a medallion given her by her French grandmother with the image upon it of Michael Archangel, and she wished you to have his protection. May the 10th, 1780, Savannah. It was a stormy day, and cold on the quay, with a strong wind whipping up whitecaps on the river and bent on whipping off their hats as well.
The tender had almost finished loading, its last load bound for the cargo holds of the army transport Hermione, waiting at anchor.
Have you ever been on a ship? William asked suddenly.
No, just canoes.
Cinnamon was twitching like a nervous horse, ready to bolt.
What's it like?
Exciting sometimes, William said in what he hoped was a tone of reassurance. Mostly boring, though. Here, I brought you a going-away present.
He reached into the pocket of his coat and drew out a small jar of murky liquid and a smaller vial with a dropper.
Just in case, he told Cinnamon, handing these over. Dilled cucumber pickles and ether, in case of seasickness.
Cinnamon eyed the gifts dubiously, but nodded.
You suck a pickle if you feel queasy, William explained. If that doesn't work, take 6 drops of the ether. You can put it in beer if you like, he added helpfully.
Thank you.
The wind had restored Cinnamon's usual ruddy glow.
Thank you, he said again,
and seized William's hand in a grasp of crushing earnestness.
And tell your sister how much.
How much? The tide of rising emotion choked him, and he shook his head and wrung William's hand harder.
You told her, William said, easing the hand free and repressing an urge to count his fingers. She was happy to do it.
She's happy for you.
So am I,
he added, patting Cinnamon affectionately on the forearm, as much to avoid being seized again as from the very real affection he felt.
I'll miss you, you know, he added diffidently.
He would, and the realization struck him like a blow behind the ear. He felt suddenly hollow, but couldn't think of anything else to say.
Mosey,
Cinnamon said, and looked down at his new boots, clearing his throat.
All aboard?
The naval lieutenant, captaining the tender, was glaring down at them.
Now, gentlemen.
William picked up the new portmanteau, a gift from Lord John, and thrust it into Cinnamon's hand.
Go, he said, smiling as hard as he could.
Write to me from London. Cinnamon nodded, speechless, then at another irate shout from the tender, turned and lumbered blindly aboard. The tender's sails dropped and filled at once, and within a minute they were in the middle of the river, flying toward the unknown future. William watched the little ship out of sight, then turned back toward Bay Street with a sigh, his sense of loss tinged by envy.
Au revoir, Michel,
he said under his breath.
Now who am I going to talk to?
Chapter 125. A woman of the second type, Savannah. Once Cinnamon had gone, William moved from the small house they had shared back into Lord John's house at his father's invitation. Amaranthus, Lord John said firmly, needed company.
She doesn't accept invitations, he told William, and only goes out now and then to the shops.
She must be in low spirits, William said. He'd meant it jokingly, but the way in which his father glared at him made him feel ashamed.
Surely you've told her that no one knows?
Of course I have,
Lord John said impatiently.
So has Hal, with a surprising amount of delicacy. She just hangs her head and says she can't bear to be seen. On display was the rather odd way she put it.
Oh, said William, somewhat enlightened.
Well, that does make more sense.
It does.
Well, William said, a little awkwardly,
as a young widow, and the mother of the heir to Uncle Hal's title, she did attract, a good deal of interest. At parties and dinners and that sort of thing, I mean.
And enjoyed such interest very much, so far as I could see,
his father observed cynically, giving him a sidelong look. Quite. William turned aside, picking up and pretending to examine a Meissen plate from the sideboard.
But now she's been exposed, so to speak, even if only among us.
He coughed. I think perhaps she feels she can't act the part of a beautiful young widow, and
She'd feel somewhat conscious flirting with fat-heady young men, knowing that even if neither Hal nor I was present, we'd likely hear about it.
Lord John appeared to find this dubious but plausible. Then he made the next inevitable, William supposed, deduction.
After all, what would she do if one of the bright young sparks she touched caught fire and asked for her hand?
Lord John frowned, the next thing having occurred to him. He looked hastily over his shoulder, then moved closer to William and lowered his voice.
What would she have done if that happened and we didn't know the truth?
William shrugged and spread his hands in an affectation of complete ignorance.
God knows, he said, with complete truth. But it didn't. Lord John looked as though he wanted to say something else, but instead merely shook his head and moved the plate 2 inches back into its exact position.
Perhaps she could go to luncheons, or tea parties, or quilting routes, William hazarded. Things with just women, I mean.
His father laughed shortly.
There are 2 kinds of women in the world, he said, those who enjoy the company of women, and those who prefer the company of men. For one reason or another, he added fairly, it's not always to do with lust or marriage.
And you imply that Amaranthus is not one of the first type.
William, it's sufficiently obvious that even you will have noticed it. And I assure you the other women have. Women of the first type dislike women of the second type, particularly if the woman of the second type is young, beautiful, and possessed of either charm or money.
He ran a hand through his hair, still thick and blonde, though showing traces of white near his face.
I suppose I could beg Mrs. Holmes or Lady Prevost to ask Amaranthus to a hen party of some sort, but I very much doubt that she'd go.
And even knowing what you do, William said quite gently, you like her, and worry that she's lonely. After all, the situation's not her fault.
His father sighed heavily. He was looking rather dishevelled, and a faint smell of spoilt milk hung about him, likely connected to the imperfectly cleaned whitish stain on his charcoal-coloured sleeve. Trevor had been weaned, but had not yet mastered the mysteries of drinking from a cup.
You need a nursemaid, William said.
Yes, I do, his father said promptly. You.
He couldn't say he was sorry to be back in Oglethorpe Street. Bachelor living with John Cinnamon had been pleasant enough, and it was good to have a friend always at hand to share whatever came along. But he was happy, if a little anxious, for Cinnamon. The small house they'd shared on the edge of the marsh seemed damp and desolate, and his spirits sank when the sun went down, leaving him alone in the shadows with the smell of mud and dead fish. It was good now to wake in the morning to sunlight and the noises of people in the house below. And then there was the food. Whatever Moira's intransigence with regard to grilled tomatoes, the woman was a phoenix with fish, shellfish, and roasted alligator with apricot sauce. She had even, with a little persuasion and the gift of a bottle of good brandy, allowed Lord John to teach her how to make potatoes dauphinoise. And then there was Amaranthus. He saw at once what Lord John had meant. She was subdued, picking away at her needlework with eyes downcast, only speaking when someone spoke to her. Polite always, but always distant, as though her thoughts were elsewhere. Probably in New Jersey, he thought, and was surprised to feel a sort of sympathy for her. It truly wasn't her fault. William set himself to bring her back into cordial society, and in the process found that some parts of his own character that he had set aside over the last year were not, in fact, dead. He was beginning to dream at night about England. They played games in the evening, chess, draughts, backgammon, dominoes. If Hal or someone else was there for supper, they played whist or brag. And all 3 men smiled to see Amaranthus light up in the fire of competition. She was a cutthroat card player
and played chess like a cat, her changeable eyes fixed on the board as though the chessmen were mice, an imaginary tail gently waving to and fro behind her shoulder until she pounced and showed her white teeth. Still, the sense of merely passing time was slightly oppressive. The whole city was pervaded by a similar atmosphere, though the sense of suspended activity had a deep and urgent reason. With the French ships gone, and Lincoln and the Americans retreated to Charlestown, Savannah had gone about picking up the pieces. Houses broken by cannon had been repaired as quickly as possible, but with the spring had come fresh paint, and the bright pinks, yellows, and blues of the city bloomed anew. The abatis and redoubts outside the city remained, though the winter storms and high tides had eroded the farthest defences. The remnants of the American camp had all but disappeared by now, salvaged by slaves and apprentices. But if the thoughts of Benjamin in New Jersey lay under Amaranthus's outward composure, the thought of Charlestown was openly and constantly in the minds of the Savannah garrison. Dispatches came frequently, with news from New York and Rhode Island, where Sir Henry Clinton was staging his troops for a voyage. Hal, being who he was, and John, being not only his brother, but also his lieutenant colonel, the household was well aware of General Clinton's intent to attack Charlestown as soon as the weather allowed of such an adventure. All through April, dispatches had arrived by ship and by rider in an increasing flurry of excitement and intensity. As the siege progressed, Uncle Hal strode to and fro outside his house, unable to bear confinement, but not wanting to leave lest any news arrive in his momentary absence. "It's highly unlikely that we'll need to move more men to Charlestown," Lord John had told William, who had just likened his uncle to a pregnant cat on the verge of delivering kittens. "Clinton's got plenty of men and artillery. He's got Cornwallis, and whatever its other faults, the British Army does know how to conduct a siege. Still, if, or rather when, the city falls, we might be summoned, and if so, it will be in an almighty hurry. But chances are we'll just be left here cooling our heels," he added warningly, seeing the eager look on William's face. He paused thoughtfully, though, looking at his son.
"Would you think of taking up a commission should that happen?" he asked.
William's first impulse was to say yes, of course, and it was clear that his father saw that, for while Lord John had done his best to avoid saying anything to William regarding his future, the mention of a commission had brought a faint gleam of hope into his father's face. William took a deep breath, though, and shook his head.
"I don't know," he said. "I'll think about it."
Savannah was in bloom, the squares and gracious streets covered with magnolia petals and fallen azalea blooms, gardenias, jasmine, and wisteria, perfuming the air and charming the eye. Lord John's house, cozy and warm through the winter, seemed suddenly confined and unbearably stuffy. William persuaded Amaranthus to come out with him for a walk, to enjoy the morning air and the cooling breeze from the sea. And she did seem to enjoy it. Her head rose proudly, and she went so far as to nod pleasantly to ladies that she knew, most of whom bowed or nodded graciously back. William smiled and bowed too, though he saw the speculative looks on the faces under the broad straw hats and lacy bonnets. A couple of pursed lips and sidelong glances, too. "They're disappointed," Amaranthus remarked, sounding mildly amused. "They think I've ensnared you."
"Let them," William replied, briefly patting the hand she'd placed in the crook of his arm. "Though if you disdain to exhibit your capture in public, we could walk down to the beach."
They paused at the head of the stone steps that led down to the water at the end of Bay Street and took off their shoes and stockings. The stone was wet and slippery, but felt wonderful on the soles of William's bare feet. The sand felt even better, and releasing Amaranthus's hand, he shucked his coat and ran away far down the beach, the unbuckled knees of his breeches flapping and seabirds calling overhead. He came back blown and happy to find that she'd taken off her hat and cap, unpinned her hair, and was dancing on the sand, curtsying to an unseen lover, whirling away and back again, hand outstretched. He laughed, and coming to her from behind, took the hand, turned her toward him, bowed, and kissed her knuckles. She laughed too, and they sauntered slowly down the beach, the damp sand rising up between their toes. They hadn't spoken since they'd reached the beach, and there seemed no need. There were a few people on the beach, fishermen, women netting shrimp in the shallows or digging for clams, and idlers like themselves. No one gave them more than a casual glance. By unspoken consent, they turned and headed away from the town, out through the grass and up the river, passing a half-buried remnant of canvas, once an army tent, now left flapping in the wind. At last they stopped, knowing they had come far enough, and stood for some time, watching fishing boats and barges coming down the river, and rowboats and dories crossing to the other side where a few warehouses awaited the goods they bore. Amarantha sighed, and William thought there was something wistful in her face, as though she wished she, too, could sail free upon the water.
"You could get a divorce, you know," he blurted.
She turned her head sharply, body tensed, and looked him up and down as though to determine whether this was an ill-timed attempt at wit. Concluding that it wasn't, she let her shoulders relax and merely said, "No, I couldn't," in the patient tone one might use to tell a child why he oughtn't to put his hand into the fire.
"Certainly, well, almost certainly," he corrected himself. "You could. I've been thinking that I must go back to England soon, to deal with things. You could travel with me under my protection. Ben's not a duke yet, but he's still a peer. That means a divorce would have to be granted by the House of Lords, and they'd do it in a flash once they heard about General Bleecker. Mere infidelity is one thing. Treason's quite another kettle of fish."
Her nostrils whitened, but she kept her temper. "That is exactly what I mean, William. Do you think I haven't thought of divorce? How brainless do you think I am?"
There wasn't any sort of good answer to that question, and he wisely didn't try.
"What do you mean by exactly, then?" he asked instead.
"I mean treason," she said, exasperated. "What else could I mean? As you say, if I were to petition the House of Lords for a divorce on the basis that Ben has abandoned me, not for a trollop, but for General Washington, they'd grant it in a heartbeat, if I could prove it. And I do think you'd come and testify to it, if need be, William."
She gave him half of a rueful smile before returning to her argument. "And the newspapers and broadsheets and every salon in London would be buzzing for weeks, no months, about it. What would that do to your uncle, to his wife, his brother, to Ben's brothers and his sister? How could I possibly do that to them?" She made a passionate gesture, flinging out her arms in frustration. "The regiment? Even if the king didn't disband it outright, he'd never trust Father Pardlow again, neither would the army."
"I see," he said stiffly after a moment's silence. He took a breath and then took her hand carefully. She didn't jerk it away or slap him, though she didn't respond to his touch either.
"I only want to say that I didn't suggest divorce from any motive of self-interest," he said quietly. "I thought you might suppose..."
She'd been fixedly looking out at the water, but turned at that and met his eyes, her look straight and serious, eyes grey as the overcast sky. "I might have," she said softly. She was close enough that her skirts, stirring in the breeze, wrapped round his naked calves, and kissing his knuckles lightly, she let go his hand.
"We should," she began, but then stopped dead, staring.
"What's that?" He turned to look and saw a naval cutter, ensign flying in the wind, tearing down the river toward them. As it passed, he caught a flash of army uniforms aboard.
"News," he said, "from Charlestown. Let's go."
They saw the cutter at the quay as they hurried back, then a small group of army and naval officers laboriously climbing the slippery stone stairway to Bay Street. William inflated his lungs and bellowed, "Has Charlestown fallen?" Most of the officers ignored him, but a young ensign, trailing at the end of the group, turned and shouted, "Yes!" with a beaming countenance. The young man was hastily grabbed by the arm and dragged along, but the group was plainly in too much hurry to waste time on official rebuke. "Oh, dear God!" Amaranthus was panting, pressing the heel of her hand into her corset. William had quite forgotten her in the excitement, but at once took the shoes and stockings from her other hand and urged her to sit down and let him help reshoe her. She did, and laughed in small, breathless spurts. "Really, William, what do you think me? A mare?"
"No, no, certainly not. A filly, maybe."
He grinned at her and pulled her last stocking up to her knee. He had to leave her shoe buttons undone, having no buttonhook, and no clue how to use one if he had, but he tied her garters briskly, and she could at least walk. "They'll have gone to Prevost's headquarters," he told her, as they reached Oglethorpe Street. "I'll see you to Papa's house, and I'll go find out the details."
"Come back as soon as you can," she said.
She was wind-blown and panting, with red splotches on her cheeks from trotting over the cobblestones.
"Please, William."
He nodded, and handing her in at the gate, strode off in the direction of General Prevost's headquarters. By the time he returned, it was well after tea time, but Moira and Amaranthus and Lord John's new housekeeper, a tall, irritable woman aptly named Miss Crab, had kept some cake for him and were all waiting impatiently to hear the news. "Partly it was the slaves," William explained, licking a crumb from the corner of his mouth. Sir Henry had already put out a proclamation offering freedom to any slave of a rebel American who might choose to fight for the British Army, and when this was reiterated to the countryside around Charlestown, there was quite an outpouring of men from both countryside and the city. And as these were men with a strong knowledge of the terrain, as you might say. Moira refilled his teacup, eyes gleaming over the squat grey teapot.
"You mean to say as how 'twas black men that turned upon their masters, and that's how the city fell?
Good on 'em."
"Mrs. O'Meara," Miss Crabb exclaimed, "you cannot mean that."
"The devil I don't," Moira replied stoutly, plunking the pot back on the table with such force that tea sputtered across the cloth. "And you'd mean the same if you'd ever been denture like I was. Death to the masters, says I."
Amaranthus uttered a shocked laugh, and tried to turn it into a coughing fit by burying her face in a handkerchief. "Well, I do gather that Lord Cornwallis and his regulars had some hand in the surrender," William said, keeping his countenance with some difficulty. "He led his troops onto the mainland while Sir Henry was capturing the offshore islands, and besieged the city with cannon and trenches. And whilst all this was going on, in mid-April Sir Henry sent two of his officers to take a place called Monk's Corner. Bannister Tarleton, I know him, very vigorous officer, and Patrick Ferguson, they..."
"You know Ban Tarleton?" Amaranthus said, surprised. "I know him too. How funny. I trust he escaped injury?"
"So far as I know, yes," William said, surprised too.
He was reasonably sure that nothing short of a cannonball at close range would have made a dent in Tarleton. He'd had a brief passage with the man over Jane, and the thought conjured up a host of feelings he didn't want to deal with. He swallowed tea and coughed a little.
"I've not heard of Ferguson. Do you know him?"
He supposed it wasn't odd that she should. Prior to turning his coat, Ben had been a major in the British Army, and his battalion was, so far as William knew, still with Clinton. She shrugged a little. "I met Major Ferguson once. A small, pale, Scottish creature with a crippled arm. Very intense, though, with those sort of pale, gooseberry eyes."
"I suppose he is. Intense, I mean. Sir Henry sent him out to collect loyalists for a provincial militia, and I understand he's done quite well. His loyalists fought with Major Tarleton's troops,
to take Monk's Corner, and that cut off the main line of retreat for the Americans, so then...
Before he had told them all he'd heard, the table was a wreck of empty plates, spilled saucers and lines of sugar, pepper and salt, illustrating the movements of Clinton's army.
And so Charlestown fell day before yesterday, William ended, slightly hoarse from talking. Lincoln had offered to give up the city 3 weeks before, if his men were allowed to walk out unharmed. Clinton knew he had the stronger hand, though, and kept up the bombardment until Lincoln finally surrendered unconditionally. 5,000 men, they said, all taken prisoner. A whole army. Is there more tea, please, Moira?
There is,
she said, getting ponderously to her feet. But if it was my choice to make, son, I'd be getting out the fine brandy. Seems as though such a victory's deserving of it.
This notion passed by general acclamation, and by the time Lord John arrived home, well past midnight, there were no more clean glasses, and only an inch of brandy left in the last bottle. Lord John eyed the shambles of his sitting room, shrugged, sat down, and, picking up the bottle, drained it.
How are you, Papa?
William had stayed up, leaving the women to make their separate ways to bed, and had sat by the fire, thinking. Sharing the general glow of the victory, to be sure, but envious, too, of the men who had won it. He missed the camaraderie of the army, but more than that, he missed the sense of shared purpose, the knowledge that he had a part to play, people who depended upon him. The army had its strictures, and not inconsiderable ones either. But by contrast, his present life was shapeless and lacking something. Everything.
I'm fine, Willie, his father said affectionately.
Lord John was plainly exhausted, held up mostly by his uniform, but clearly in good spirits.
I'll tell you everything tomorrow.
Yes, of course. William got up, and seeing his father put his feet under him, but then hesitate as though uncertain what came next, smiled and bent to hoist Lord John out of his chair. He held on to his father's arm for a moment to make sure he was steady, and felt the solid warmth of his body, got the smell of a man, a soldier, sweat and steel, red wool and leather.
You asked whether I might consider buying a commission, William said abruptly, surprising himself. I did.
Lord John was swaying a little on his feet. Clearly the inch of brandy just consumed was only the icing on his evening's cake, but his eyes were clear, if bloodshot, and met William's with a quizzical approval.
You should be certain, though.
I know, William said. I'm only thinking.
It's not a bad time to rejoin, his father said judiciously. You want to get in before the fun's over, I mean. Cornwallis says the Americans won't last another winter. Bear that in mind.
I will, said William, smiling. His own level of intoxication wasn't much below his father's, and he felt a warm benevolence for the army, England, and even my Lord Cornwallis, though he normally considered that gentleman to be a tiresome nit.
Good night, Papa.
Good night, Willie. The beginning of a battle is usually much better defined than its ending, and even though Charlestown concluded with a formal and unconditional surrender, the aftermath was, as usual, long, drawn out, complicated, and messy. The flood of dispatches did not abate, though the ratio of excitement to tedium dropped considerably. More parts of the Savannah garrison were indeed carved off and sent north, but to guard prisoners and escort them to prison hulks or other insalubrious quarters rather than to join in glorious battle.
At least at the end of our siege, Lincoln took his army off with him, William remarked to his father and uncle. Less to tidy up, I mean. Took them off north so Cornwallis could bag them all, you mean?
Uncle Hal was inclined to be snappish, but William had been around soldiers for the majority of his life, and recognized the poisonous, slow-sapping nature of tension that could not be discharged in a good fight, resulting in prickliness and disgruntlement.
At least Ben wasn't there,
Uncle Hal added, in a tone that made Papa look sharply at him.
Save me having to shoot him myself to keep him from being hanged.
One corner of his mouth jerked up, in an apparent attempt to make this sound like a joke. Neither his brother nor his nephew was fooled. A muffled gasp from the door made all three men glance round to see Amaranthus in her calico jacket and straw hat, she having evidently been out. She had a hand pressed over her mouth, either to keep from saying whatever she was thinking, or perhaps to keep from vomiting, William thought. She was white as one of Lord John's porcelain figurines, and William moved to take her arm in case she was about to faint. She took her hand away from her mouth and let him lead her to a chair, giving Uncle Hal a horrified look as she went. He went a dull red and cleared his throat with a strong "Umph."
"I didn't mean it," he said unconvincingly.
Amaranthus breathed for a few moments, her bosom stirring the folds of her pale blue fichu. She shook her head slightly, as though rejecting the advice of an angel on her shoulder, and clenched her gloved hands upon her knee.
"Do you truly mean you would prefer him to be dead?" she said, in a voice like cut glass. "Is his being a traitor more important than his being your son?"
Hal closed his eyes, his face going blank. Lord John and William exchanged uneasy glances, not knowing what to do. Hal grimaced slightly and opened his eyes, pale blue and cold as winter.
"He made his choice," he said, speaking directly to Amaranthus. "I can't change that. And I would rather have him killed cleanly than captured and executed as a traitor. A good death might be the only thing I still could give him."
He turned and left the room quietly, leaving no sound but the hissing of the candles burning behind him. William was dressing to go down for breakfast the next morning when a frenzied pounding on his door interrupted him. He opened it to see Miss Crabbe in her wrapper and curling papers holding Trevor, who was in a red-faced passion. "She's gone off," the housekeeper said, and shoved the howling child into his arms. "He's been bellowing for nearly an hour, and I couldn't stand it. I really couldn't. So I went down and found this." He hadn't a hand to spare, but she waved a folded note at him in accusation, then stuffed it between his chest and Trevor, unwilling to suffer its touch any longer.
You've read it?"
he asked as politely as possible, shifting Trev to one arm in order to pluck the note out of his shirt front. The housekeeper puffed up like an angry, if scrawny, hen. "Are you accusing me of impertinence, sir?" she demanded, above the noise of Trevor's wail of "Mama, mama, mama, mama." Then she looked down and noticed that William, who had not assumed his breeches yet, was standing there unshaved and barefoot in nothing but his shirt. She gasped, turned, and fled. William was beginning to wonder whether perhaps he hadn't awakened at all and was in the midst of a nightmare. But Trevor put paid to that notion by biting his arm. He hoiked Trevor onto his shoulder, patted his back in a businesslike manner, and carried him downstairs, still shrieking, in search of assistance. He felt oddly calm, in the way that one sometimes is during nightmares, merely watching as terrible things transpire.
"She's gone."
He hadn't the slightest doubt that Miss Crabbe was right. He couldn't get beyond the simple fact of Amaranthus's disappearance, though.
"She's gone."
The part of his mind capable of asking questions and making speculations was either still asleep or shocked into paralysis. He pushed the door to the dining room open and went in. Lord John was sitting at the table in his purple-striped banyan, dipping toast into the yolk of a soft-boiled egg, but at the sight of William and his burden, he dropped the toast and shoved back his chair.
"What the devil's happened?"
he asked sharply, coming to William at once. He reached for Trevor.
"Where's Amaranthus?"
"She's gone," William said, and the speaking of the words aloud opened a sudden hollow inside his chest as though someone had scooped out his heart. He carefully unclenched his hand and dropped the crumpled note on the table.
"She left this." "Read it,"
Lord John said shortly. He had thrust an eggy toast soldier into Trevor's mouth, magically silencing him, and now sat down, balancing the child on his knee. "Dear Uncle John," William read, conscious of his heartbeat thumping in his ears. "It distresses me beyond measure to leave you in this way, but I cannot bear to remain longer. I thought of saying that I was going off to drown myself in the marshes, but I should not like Trevor to believe his mother a suicide, though I should not mind his grace suffering the pangs of conscience in believing he had driven me to such an expedient. I have made arrangements to return to my father's house in Philadelphia. I leave my darling in your care, knowing that he will be safe with you. It tears my heart to leave him, but the journey is not safe. Beyond that, Trevor is the heir to his grace's estates and title. He should be brought up with the knowledge of his heritage and the responsibilities that go with it. I trust his grace to provide that. I trust you to provide the constant love and security that a child requires. Please believe that I am grateful, beyond my ability to say, for all your kindness and care of me and my son. I will write as soon as I have reached my destination. I will miss you. I feel as though I write this farewell with my own heart's blood. But I remain your niece, Amaranthus, Viscountess Grey. Chapter 126. When I go to sleep at night, I die. Fraser's Ridge, June 18th, 1780. The Mackenzies' room was quiet. The house had gone to bed, and even Adso, who had wandered in and curled up on Brianna's lap an hour ago, was snoring in a sort of syncopated purr, interrupted by small mirp noises as he spotted dream mice. The noise had roused Roger from his doze. He lay on his side, watching his wife through a pleasant haze of the sleep that had left him, but not gone far. As with all redheads, the colour of her hair depended on the light in which one saw her, brown in shadow, blazing in sunlight, and by the light of a low-burning fire, a fall of changing colour, sparked with threads of gold. She was writing slowly, lifting her quill now and then to frown at the page in search of a word, a thought. Adso stirred, yawned, and began to knead her thighs and belly, claws prickling through her shift and wrapper. She hissed through her teeth and pushed back from the table. "You leave something to be desired as a muse," she whispered to the cat, putting down her quill and carefully detaching his claws. She scooped him up, rose, and took him to the bed where Roger lay, curled up in the bedclothes, eyes almost closed. She set Adso down at the foot of the bed and stood back to watch. The cat stretched luxuriously, then, without opening his own eyes, oozed slowly up the bed and curled into the spot between Roger's face and shoulder, purring loudly. Roger slid a hand under Adso, picked him up and dropped him unceremoniously onto the floor.
"Are you coming to bed soon?"
he asked sleepily, brushing cat hairs away from his mouth. "Right now," she assured him. She shrugged out of her wrapper and tossed it on the floor, where Adso, who'd been blinking grouchily, promptly took possession of the nice warm nest thus provided, and settled down on it, eyes going back to blissful slits. Brianna blew the candle out. Roger heard the tiny spatter of wax droplets on the tabletop.
"That cat sounds like a motorboat. Why is he in here anyway? Oughtn't he to be out in the barn hunting vermin?"
Roger lifted